So the event is, as you said, in celebration of the Martin Luther King holiday. So it's a performance, which is a brief one by me to open for Dominique, who's our primary feature. And I think it's going to be pretty incredible. Just a wonderful night of performance poetry.
Indeed. Denver is really, well, Denver and the whole Front Range is a place that's really known for our Martin Luther King observances on the holiday, that people use it as an opportunity for either, you know, service or remembrance, more than an opportunity to, like, perhaps return holiday gifts that didn't fit or something like this. Have you, like, grown up in the tradition of celebrating this holiday here?
Grown up in the tradition of I don't know how to answer that exactly, because I come from a family that is steeped in the civil rights movement, and so every day is sort of an opportunity to remember the folks who sacrificed a lot. But I do remember going to the MLK marches when I was young, and I remember it being both wonderful and awe-inspiring and also at times kind of terrifying, and moments of violence. And so, yeah, I mean, I in one way or another, I feel like I have been celebrating it.
No doubt. Your experience, so give us a little bit of that family history.
My family matriculated from Little Rock, Arkansas in 1958. They came here. My grandfather and my grandmother were school teachers in Little Rock, Arkansas. My Aunt Carlotta, who lives here as well, was one of nine students that desegregated Central High School in Little Rock, Arkansas. She received the Congressional Medal of Honor for that, but it is a history that is a heavy one, and a history that I feel beholden to. And so it's, I'm never guilty of relegating these conversations to symbolism or, you know, empty gesture, because I'm relative to the people who sacrificed much and who lost a lot in the interest of making our country and our society better.
And how has that inspired your writing?
I think it's all over it. I think I am something of an elegiac poet. I think I'm constantly trying to operate from ancestral logic. I think I'm constantly trying to reflesh the bones and bring folks back into the space, folks who left, oftentimes folks who they were gone before I was ever here, but whose memory and whose legacy still is attached to my body and my consciousness and how I live my life. So it's all over the writing. The writing is, in many respects, a way to bring those people back into the room and name them, and give them the space that they deserve.
Dominique, Christina, you've performed and conducted workshops for hundreds of colleges and universities, schools, community art spaces, nonprofit organizations, and conferences. You're so driven by the word. Could you share one of the pieces with us that you're going to be presenting?
I can find something to read, but I never know what I'm going to read in the moment.
Okay.
I need to be in the space and look at faces and feel the room and all of that, because to me it's still conjure. And it's still ritual. And so I've never been able to pull off a set list, you know, like in advance of a show. So I could find something to read for you, but there's no guarantee that poem would show up on stage for that event.
And this is what you're referring to as you don't conduct empty gestures.
Right. Right, because I need to be in a space of willingness with whatever it is that I'm reading. And there are things that I've written that on any given day, I don't feel really willing to share it that day, you know? And so I give myself permission to be available to the words and to mean them every time. So I don't do muscle memory, like, you know, rote kinds of, you know, I've read this poem 1,000 times, it's light work, here I go. I don't function that way. I've never been able to function that way. I need to be in my body the whole time, and feel what, you know, like what it is that I'm going to be offering and how it's going to bounce off of the other bodies in the room and how it will be received and what is needed. So it's a little bit a little bit of alchemy, you know, involved in performance for me.
That's brilliant.
You think so?
I do. I really encourage that approach for anybody listening to these words, to not rely upon muscle memory or just like your greatest hits.
Sure.
Incredible. Well, could you share something that is coming to mind here in the studio?
Oh, America, I went out looking for what you promised and found a toothless grin, an empty pot, boneyard lullabies, sweetless shores, witches burned to cinder, little black girls bombed in churches, they are all me. Each charred bone, each torn dress is the story of my birth. I'm a wandering ghost here, this mud-struck witch pledging allegiance to the pitchfork, stupidly sturdy anyhow. My Easter dress is my winding cloth. You tried to kill me, made my death tradition. But I'm stubborn in this skin. It does not matter what weapons you point. I roll the stone away, outlast death, abandon it in the cause of my name, my holy, my righteous name. What will you do, America? What can you do with this cliff-hanging colored girl who pioneered her own dumb body despite the ambulance ride you turned things into? See how incurably permanent I am. See how these skeletons tumble out of my mouth. The grisly burst of unnamed corpses that hang above my head, a halo of deliberate memory. Oh, America, you put a war in my veins, hoped I'd die from the poison or be disappeared by debris, but I grew past the bile and carry too many grave jumpers in my photo album to succumb to your kind of death ritual. 1619 was this morning. I can feel the first cargo of trembling Africans fighting to keep their names in a place too indulgent in blood sport. They are all me. Each one is me. I have inherited a swarm of bees for blood. What will you do, America? What cemetery can you possibly build for a girl so full of memory? Oh, okay. Oh, we're snapping. Oh, okay. Yeah, that's still good. Yeah.
That's still cool. Okay, cool. Incredible. Dominique, I also just have a question. We formerly have known you as the poet named Dominique Ashahid. Mm-hmm. And you're presenting Dominique Christina now. Mm-hmm. Why the transition?
In part, it's about just growth. You know, Ashahid is Arabic, to bear witness. So in a lot of respects, I needed to give myself permission to do that. Christina is my middle name. I'm named for my grandmother, Christine Johnson. And as I got into more and more into the weight of myself and the weight of the work, I feel her presence most often. Sort of hanging around, you know, hissing in my ear, hovering over every line. And so it felt appropriate and in alignment with what I was trying to do in terms of conjure and ritual, to invoke her name, that her name gets invoked when mine gets invoked.
Can you enlighten our listeners a little bit about that process? You know, the magic, the alchemy that goes into putting pen to pad?
I think it's different for every poet. I'm sure Natalie has a different process than I do. I think for me, it took me so long to say anything at all. I'm an accidental poet. I had no intention of being a poet, and I certainly had no intention of being in front of an audience. And so that process was a slow process for me. I had to travel the distance of myself in order to arrive in a place where I could be authentic and mean it and know I wouldn't die, because I really actually felt like I would die by saying some of the things that were coming from me. My process as a writer, and again, it's a journey, but I know that I made a decision right around the time that my twins, who are 17 now, they were less than a year old, and I found myself really just feeling so depressed and so sad all the time, and realizing that I had not written anything in a while. I was mothering, and I was parenting, and I was diapering, and, you know, doing all these things, but I was not, I didn't have any integrity with the part of myself that needed, you know, to still have light in it and around it. And so I made a commitment to write every day from that point forward, and I've done so. So my relationship to writing is the same relationship that I have to eating and sleeping. I feel like I have to do it or I'll die. And when I come to the page, I come without an agenda. I never know what I'm gonna say. And it's very much like falling in the dark. But I trust that I won't die if I fall, or that there will be hands that jut out to hold me gentle. But I never know what's going to come out of me. And oftentimes what happens is the first line, and that first line is mysterious to me. And then the rest of the writing is about chasing down the meaning of that first line and trusting the process the whole way.
Well, Natalie Sharp, you are an emerging poet here in the Denver scene. You're pursuing your Master's of Fine Arts in Creative Writing with concentration in poetry from University of Colorado Boulder, and you're also teaching creative writing. How do you approach or encourage the writing process?
Yeah, for me, I think a lot of the organic nature of the process that Dominique referred to is true for me as well. So it's really just starting somewhere, and then the way that I construct poems tends to be more piecemeal, I suppose. I'll write a bunch of things, and then some of those things will have common themes or elements that fit together, and those will end up pieced together in a way that feels cohesive. As far as encouraging the writing process, I endeavor to let my students feel safe and to know that their experimentation is welcome, that their questions are welcome, that this is the kind of space where they should be playing with words, playing with language, doing what their instinct inclines them to do rather than necessarily following the rules that I'm giving them. It's like, I want you to have tools. You don't have to use them this way forever. And a lot of those rules should be broken anyway.
How do you feel like people can really transform themselves through the experience of writing?
I think just keep doing it. So much of the reason that people never realize the value of writing is because they tell themselves that they're not supposed to write. They're not supposed to have their words heard, and they're not meant to be known. And starting from a belief that, like, your words matter, what you have experienced matters, and your experience can't be replicated by anyone else, allows you to really continue to explore in your writing. And I think writing itself requires a lot of inward focus. So that growth sort of happens naturally if you are open to the process of it.
Here, I'm going to go out on a little bit of a limb here. You know, many of us engage in this constant communication and typing, a sort of written communication that's like required or that we feel is, you know, demanded of us, whether it's our work parameters or our social constraints. How much does our like need to communicate all of this other stuff in email forms and social media, how does that impact our ability to write creatively?
I think that's an interesting question. But I also think that they're operating very differently. Those things are operating very differently. You know, I for me anyway, poetry gets to be lawless. You know, it's lawless language. You know, it's where color has a sound. You know, it's where if you want to drag a mermaid out of the ocean, you can do so. All of that is available to you in creative writing. And so I think, you know, you can, we bifurcate all the time. Our thoughts are bifurcated all the time. And so, you know, writing an email where you're trying to confirm an appointment can happen in the brain alongside, you know, this wildly creative piece that's using magical realism and that transcends, you know, that which we agree is reality. And so I think they both can function in the same body at the same time, you know. I don't think that operating in one vein negates the other or diminishes your capacity for the other, you know.
And to add on to that, I think in some ways, given the advent of poetry and other forms of creative writing showing up on social media, sometimes those processes are one and the same. Not always, but in a number of cases, folks might be doing a lot of their composition on their social media pages. Beyond that, I think it's also interesting oh, maybe I don't think it's interesting. Nope, that thought's gone.
Okay. Right. It can provide the avenue for expression and allow people to see your work. It's an interesting thing because, like, within the rap community in Denver, you know, many people graduate out of the rap community, no longer feel the need to express themselves through song and through rhyming, and wind up in different professions and in different, you know, families. And I kind of wonder what happens to that part of my colleagues' brains, and even where it's going with myself.
Say more about that.
It's interesting because in like the mid to late 90s to the early 2000s, like a lot of people were very adamant about expressing themselves through rhyme form, mm-hmm. rapping here in Denver. And now a lot of the, you know, the people that were in that scene are just not actively committed to expressing themselves through rapping. And I don't know if it's because of like the peskiness of, you know, when you put yourself out there as a rapper, there's always a lot of pushback. In particular, the rapper is sort of a lightning rod for negativity. People say, oh, you express a lot of negativity, but people feel negatively about rappers in a way, mm-hmm. In my experience. And I don't know if people just sort of feel like it's not worth it, or that they've said what they have to say about that time in their lives.
I don't know. Cause I'm not a rapper, you know, but I think hip hop is lawless too. And I think that when something is lawless, that also means that it gets to be problematic. It there's room for it to be, or the potential exists anyway, for it to be problematic, for content to not jive with our ideological thinking. I think all of that is there. I think for some folks, you know, you just transcend. I mean, I think there's room for that. There, you know, I think about Mos Def, who now goes by Yasin Bey, right? Like, you know, this rapper, but you certainly can't limit him to that moniker. He was so much more than that. You know, he demonstrated his genius in that genre, and then he started thinking about demonstrating his genius and his brilliance in other genres. And I think maybe some of that is happening, you know?
Right, that mm-hmm. there's genius is being demonstrated, but in a different capacity.
Different form.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, interesting. Well, Natalie Sharp, would you care to demonstrate some of your genius for KGNU's listeners?
Oh, goodness. Yeah, I can do that. This is a piece called My Mother's Violin. I am the sum of dimes scraped from the scum of baseball field concession stands and middle school bathrooms she cleaned for a living to give you something pretty until you could see it in yourself. You always held me the way you assumed responsibility, ginger, tender, ever the adherent to the golden rule till you perceive this world is cruel to colored girls like best friend Pam, three kids, daddy bleeding on front steps, brother verbally beating Filipino wife, uncle subtly rubbing 10-year-old breast. Rest assured, you, child, will suffer too. And soon you lose interest in me. Abandon faded faux velvet for bedsheets and boyfriends, and I learned that you'd allow the same fate to befall me that befell Eve, leaving my strings bowing in the eerie absence of a beat. This is the sound of flesh on flesh, the deafening quiet of dermis bruising, the relentless hue of black skin bluing, and the insistent recitative, trust no one, trust no one, trust no one, stricken in the key of depression, recession, regression into elementary lessons, plucking strings, my body rings hollow. Heartless, a far cry from the complex melodies of middle-aged suicidal desires passed down in leather. Open it, child. What if Pandora was a pandemic virtuoso? Set syphilis to staffs in F-clef, played the flute to drums of a chew. The woman's duty has always been to turn blame into beauty. You will not hold the sins of tens of generations over our heads. We put your sons to bed and teach our daughters acrid symphonies of abuse avoidance strategies and deferred dreams and hope. Open it, child, and play away your foremother's backaches, the taste of spoiled meat from the big house, and tell Eve we're coming.
Word up.
As we look forward to these performances at the Modus Theater, a whole weekend of celebrations and commemorations, looking at Martin Luther King Day through the lens of the civil rights struggle. But here we are in 2018, and it seems that the best thing we could hope for from lessons of the past is the ability to engender and spark a new civil rights struggle movement and the kind of societal change that people feel we are celebrating during this time. How would you say we should be approaching this?
Lord, I don't know. I don't know. I don't want to reinvent any movement because that means we haven't learned anything. That means we're still failing and flailing in the same ways, which is depressing. I think sometimes we get into that. I think we have the wrong conversations about history and with history, and it ends up where we have these romantic ideas and we attach all this romantic language, you know, and we wax so poetic about, you know, the marches and the protests, and, you know, when we held hands and we sang songs. Like, that mess was tragic and traumatic. And I, you know, I was raised by folk who had a lot of blood in their eye as a result of putting their body out there in the street, only to have it washed down by water hoses. So I want us to be willful and deliberate and radical in the conversations that we do have, and in shifting paradigm and not just repeating the processes of our parents and our grandparents. And I don't say that from a place of disrespect, but I just feel like in 2018, I have more available to me than my grandparents did. My grandfather was born in 1911. My fight should not look like his fight. That's just my truth. You know, my resistance movement should not look like his resistance movement. We should be past that. We should have grown past that. You know, there's more available to me than there ever was to him. And so in honoring and celebrating legacy, I'm also hoping that we are present to that fact that we have an obligation. I certainly feel like I have an obligation to grow past those moments in history, to be wider than that and larger than that, so that my daughter doesn't inherit that same trauma, right? Her fight shouldn't look anything like mine. Hopefully she's not fighting for the same things that I'm fighting for, because hopefully I will have done my job.
Mm. That's a word. I also feel resistant to being prescriptive about how folks observe, because some people's resistance doesn't look like mine. Right. I am a person who struggles with mental illness, and I know a lot of other people who do. And so sometimes that makes being in the streets in the ways that are most visible impossible. That doesn't mean that those folks aren't doing things. Right. That doesn't mean that we aren't staging interventions in other ways, be that in the classroom, in our personal interactions, in these other sort of micro interactions that can have cumulatively a significant effect as much as a march can. And of course, it can be easy to sort of slip into a sense of complacency of like, okay, I walked in the street and now I'm done, which is obviously not how that has ever worked, because if that was how it worked, then we wouldn't still be fighting.
It's true.